Hello and welcome to the Majlis, the podcast by Radio Free Europe, Radio Liberty, focusing on Central Asia. I am Mohammed Tahir, your host here in Washington, D.C. Much anticipated meeting of the leaders of the Caspian Littoral States held on Sunday. Issues were discussed and documents were signed, though some progress has been made, but many question if there was any tangible outcome. The positive news is the leader seems committed to continue the discussion if and when the next meeting is held. So on today's Majlis, we plan to discuss what happened in the gathering and what is next. To discuss this, I have Bruce Panier, editor of Radio Free Europe, Radio Liberty's Central Asia blog, Kishlok Owozi, who witnessed the summit unfolding on the ground in Aktau, Kazakhstan. We also have Georgi Oshakmadze, the Georgian Prime Minister's advisor for the East-West Energy Corridor, who was watching the leaders come and go just across the Caspian Sea in Tbilisi. And Robert Kutler, Dr. Robert Kutler, is joining us from Canada, who is a senior research fellow at the Institute for European, Russian and Eurasian Studies at Carleton University. And Zach Whitlin, Eurasia analyst at the Eurasia Group, is with us from Washington, D.C. Welcome on board, colleagues.
Thank you.
Thank you.
Bruce, let's start with you. There was much excitement about this summit. You went all the way from Prague to Aktau to witness this development, which some call the historic event. And now I just read your story about the conclusion of the summit. The headline reads like, Caspian Summit failed to resolve issues between Iran and its nearest neighbors. So outcome seems to be, to me, wasn't as historic as the gathering was. So what happened?
Well, I mean, I wouldn't want to downplay the deal. They agreed to a lot of things. And in fact, what's on paper is still, it still looks ironclad and extremely promising. The distressing point was that Rouhani seemed to think that there was some other additional talks that needed to be held on some of this stuff. And now, I was with Farda today talking with them about it. And then
Radio Farda, our Persian language.
Yeah, right. And apparently there's all this resistance in parliament and from the supreme leader to the deal that they just signed. What I hear from the reaction back in Tehran is that, it kind of ranges from not satisfied to totally unsatisfied with the way things shook out at the in Aktau on Sunday. You know, obviously, this is kind of a setback. Now, what kind of space Iran has to kind of tinker with this deal, I don't know. They shouldn't be able to do anything with this. But, then again, if Kazakhstan, Azerbaijan, and Russia are satisfied with their sections and how they have it divided, Russia probably might not have that much interest in what Iran's position is with Turkmenistan and Azerbaijan on its borders. Again, according to the deal, this should all be resolved, and there shouldn't be any problem anymore at all. But Iran has a history of agreeing to things and then trying to renegotiate sections of it later on, and it appears that we're kind of repeating that again.
Bruce, just to continue with you, so what Rouhani thinks is a problem here?
There's still problems as far as like the surface water. That's not really an issue, but he still has some problems with seabed issues.
May I jump in here, please?
Yeah, please. Go ahead, Dr. Cutler.
Bruce, I do not hold you responsible for the headline to your article, but I regret that I'm obliged to note that you've just repeated a common misinterpretation. First of all, there's no basis for skepticism. Everything you said about the deal being done is correct. The further negotiation that Iran Rouhani referred to has nothing to do with the seabed. It has to do with how to draw the line along the shore. You remember that they have so many nautical miles of fishing area, so many nautical miles of so on and so on. The question is, how do you draw the line along the shore to measure those 10 or 15 nautical miles from the shoreline? This is a standard problem in international law of the sea. In fact, it's addressed in the UN Convention on the Law of the Sea. And Bruce, I know that you listened to the Russian simultaneous interpretation of Rouhani's statement, as did I. And the Russian term that he used in the translation, it was Priyama Ishodni Linya, which translates into English as the straight baseline. The baseline in international law is the line that you draw along the shore of a country in order to measure 10, 15, however nautical, many nautical miles you need for the fishing zone. The question arises, what do you do when you have an island that is offshore, close by, or an archipelago, or a river delta? The answer is, and this is in Article 7 of the UN Convention of the Law of the Sea, you draw what is called the straight baseline. You adjust the baseline, which is usually a low tide watermark, and you figure out how to draw it on the map. And that is what Rouhani was referring to. And in fact, the convention signed in Aktau refers explicitly to further negotiations on drawing the straight baseline. It's the term of art. It's the baseline. It's not straight. You have to make it straight. And it's even specifically stated in the UN Convention of the Law of the Sea, Article 7, that the drawing of the straight baseline cannot be used to adjust the drawing of the territorial sea, of the sectors of the seabed. So please excuse me, but it's imperative that this interpretation should not be widespread. There is no question about the seabed. The convention itself states that no five-party requirement is required, that all agreements will be bilateral between either adjacent or opposing, that is, on different sides of the sea, countries. And it's really just a very technical issue that should not and does not prevent the observation of the convention because, and I'm sorry, this is the last thing I'll say during this particular segment, because the Vienna Convention on the Law of Treaties also states that a signatory to a treaty must observe its terms even before it has ratified the treaty. So there's really no question in my mind about this. And I thank you for the opportunity to resolve the misunderstanding.
Yeah, sure, Dr. Kutler, thank you very much for that. But, I understand the conventions that signed earlier and the ones you are referring to. But then why is it that Iranian leadership kind of have different perspective on this? I saw Foreign Minister Zarif discussing this. I guess he was at the summit and he tweeted this apparently after the agreement was signed. I'm quoting, "Day of solidarity of Caspian littoral states codifying cooperation on environment, shipping, fisheries, sustainable development and security without foreign military presence, agreeing to continue friendly dialogue on unresolved issues of delimitation, shares of sea, it is resources," unquote. So he says that there was no agreement on delimitation and discussion to continue. So
that's because the delimitation is not the concern of the convention. The convention itself states the delimitation will be done by every pair of party. As you know, Azerbaijan and Russia have a bilateral agreement for many years. Russia and Kazakhstan have a bilateral agreement for many years on delimiting their sectors. Azerbaijan and Turkmenistan have such an agreement, and Turkmenistan and Kazakhstan have such an agreement. It is true that Iran does not have such an agreement with Azerbaijan, or Azerbaijan with Turkmenistan, or Turkmenistan with Iran. But Zarif, he's just stating the fact that Iran must continue these negotiations with its neighboring countries, but that does not take anything away from the Caspian status. It does not mean that Azerbaijan and Turkmenistan cannot proceed. Actually, they could even proceed without resolving their delimitation.
Yeah. Bruce, the discussion started from your thoughts. So first, I want you to respond to this. Later, I want to have thoughts from our other panelists and their takeaways from this summit. So, Bruce.
Well, Professor Cutler knows this stuff better than anyone I can imagine. So I'm happy for his explanation. It clarifies a lot of things. You know, again, Iran is kind of erratic with any kind of agreements that it signs, with many of the agreements it signs. So I'm not sure, I understand that in principle and legally speaking, even they really don't have a case here at all. And there shouldn't be, you know, there's concerns the Trans-Caspian pipeline, you know, this shouldn't have any impact on its construction. Although, as Mr. Vashakmadze and Professor Cutler said in an earlier version, it never should have to begin with, so they could build it. You know, now how Iran's hesitation and kind of reinterpretation of some of this stuff, or calls for reinterpretation of some of this stuff, is gonna shake out, I do not know. What I would mention, though, is that our Turkmen service told me today that they also found it strange that in state media in Turkmenistan, since this deal was signed, there has been no mention of the Trans-Caspian pipeline at all, even though Putin and Berdimuhamedov met yesterday in Sochi. They're not even bringing it up. So I'm still kind of unsure of, they know something that I don't see or that we don't know yet, or what's the problem? What's the holdup with all this?
So, Zach, you have your own set of observations, perhaps reservations on what happened. How did things go there? Put them on the table, please. Also, feel free to respond to comments made by Bruce and Dr. Kuttler.
Well, sure, I'd be glad to. And I'm also happy to inject a little bit of healthy skepticism as well.
Yeah.
I agree that what was signed at the convention is what was expected, basically the version of the treaty that had already been made available in advance of the signing. And so things like the Iranian issue, I see a lot of domestic politics probably in Iran explaining why there's still such a negative reaction. Though, to be fair, in the delineation part, it laid out the principle for doing this, and Butler said it would now be up to them to work out technicalities. But there are two other issues, though, that I think we ought to make clear were really not resolved and were not intended to be resolved within this treaty. And they would depend, I think, more on further the diplomacy than strictly on technical deliberations. And this has to do, first, with the rights to lay pipelines. It is true that Turkmenistan, Azerbaijan, other countries in this agreement gained a major concession here by having the right to lay pipelines within their own sector and only within the sectors through which the pipeline passes. However, this is subject to environmental consultations that must happen alongside those pipeline projects. And it remains the right of any Caspian state to lodge environmental concerns under existing treaties. I think it was 2003 was the last major one. And there may be other addendums or international agreements that matter here. It is still possible for other states to lodge environmental concerns and slow, impede, or otherwise cause problems for a potential pipeline project. And I expect that this remains a major concern for Turkmenistan in particular. And I expect that this is part of the motivation why President Berdimuhamedov was meeting with Vladimir Putin yesterday in Sochi. I think that in order to make progress in this, we're going to need to see more diplomacy going on. We're going to need possibly even more side deals, potentially on standing economic issues that, say, Turkmenistan has with Iran and Russia, respectively, here. And I think that these are parts of the moving pieces and signposts that will actually take some time to resolve. And I'm not expecting to see great or rapid progress on the actual pipeline projects that are otherwise permitted now that this treaty has been signed, in certainly not within the next 6 months, and it could drag for longer than that.
So what you are saying is, even if there is no legal lingering issues there in Caspian Sea and sharing of this resource and all these things, but the political things might delay projects like the Trans-Caspian pipeline. Okay, so let's bring on Mr. Wojciech Matza. You look into all this from a different perspective, given your position in the government and the project that you chair. So what was your takeaway from the outcome in Aktau?
Well, the whole thing is somehow, how it is interpreted, lacks clarity, and I think that Mr. Kuttler is right, that we should clearly distinguish. So one, when we see a headline that, oh, this convention has not brought any final clarity, or it has not brought resolution of all problems, it should be clear what it is about. Yeah, it's obvious that not all problems are solved, and the question here should be, what was the realistic expectation, and why we should have been assuming that all problems will be resolved. The clear thing which Mr. Kuttler mentioned is that the issues of bilateral, and maybe at one or two points it could be even a requirement for trilateral talks when Iranian, Azeri and Turkmen kind of sectors can meet, as it's not subject for the convention. The convention has brought the rules. Now, the rules are not very easily applicable elsewhere else. You all remember the dispute which was brought to international arbitration about the island of Snake between Romania and Ukraine. And this is just in Europe. Yeah, it's not somewhere where we can say that, okay, people do not obey. So that's things, there are things where there is always something which is a subject for different interpretation, and sometimes it requires arbitration for the resolution. So that's one thing which is clear, that there is a remaining work, and this remaining work is important because this remaining work will actually give a clear answer who owns what, precisely. But again, this was not something which we should have expected. And secondly, the process has not started, is not starting after the conventions. This has been for a long history, and parties are trying to make steps to reserve their future negotiation position. So that's clear. And Iran especially gave up a lot from the position when they wanted 20%. They are now quite away from this already, but still there is a room for discussions who will get what. Now, there are two other major parts, maybe more, but at least two other major parts which is not related to these issues where there is a lack of clarity. And these two other issues is the military things and presence of the third parties and the pipeline. So these things are clear. And furthermore, they are not very well related or very directly, or they're not integral part of the other third thing. The Turkmen and Azeris, they've been saying for many years that the issue of pipelines is resolved. There was no need for them in particular to have this part in the convention. But because other parties wanted it, now it's there, and we should just happy because it's clarified.
Yeah,
within this part, we do not see too much excitement. Well, because that's what they've been saying for so long.
Yeah, they were saying, but it was not happening. Like Azerbaijan and Turkmenistan and a couple of other parties like European Union and, as you referred to, Washington, were saying that if Azerbaijan and Turkmenistan agree to implement projects like Trans-Caspian Pipeline, they can do it. But the reality is it wasn't possible to do it, and the application is lingering of that idea. But we will talk about this in length in the second part of the discussion. So just to...
If I just made a very short comment.
Sure.
Well, if the pipeline is not constructed, there is little connection that this has not been constructed because of this issue. We can discuss later on there were multiple other constraints which has been delaying this. But it's no justification to say that, well, until this was conventional signed, this was not implemented, the pipeline, and now it can be implemented. I can tell you a funny comment from one of the Russian commentators who said that, oh, now it's much more difficult for parties to build Trans-Caspian pipeline because they could do it easier in the past. Now there are much stricter environmental rules. So they should have taken time and built it earlier. Now it will be more expensive for them to build it. So it's a lot of room for interpretation. And we obviously know that other than this issue, which is just been separate, there was those things which had required an out-of-box thinking and implementation of new approaches. And that's what was missing. And now it's in place when I mentioned in the last podcast, a roadmap for implementation.
Yeah, yeah. So there are various perspectives on what this convention achieved and what Iran thinks and how legitimate is that or not. So it appears that there is no shared consensus on what happened, nor between us, nor between the parties who signed the agreement in Aktau. So let's see what are the perspective on what does this convention mean for the things going forward. We will continue the discussion talking about this and many other questions very shortly. First, let me recap the debate that today on the Majlis Radio Free Europe Radio Liberty Central Asia podcast, we are discussing the outcome of the recent high-level summit of the Caspian Littoral States and what did it do about the lingering disputes involving the sea and its resources. Joining me in the discussion are from Prague, Bruce Panier, editor of Radio Free Europe Radio Liberty Central Asia blog, Kishlok Owozi. From Tbilisi, Georgia, Georgi Washakmatsi, the Georgian Prime Minister's advisor for the East-West Energy Corridor. From Ottawa, Canada, Dr. Robert Kuttler, senior research fellow at the Institute for European, Russian, and Eurasian Studies at Carleton University. And from Washington, D.C., Zach Whitlin, Eurasia analyst at the Eurasia Group. I am Mohammed Tahir, also based in Washington, D.C. Welcome back, colleagues. So what I heard so far and what I read so far in the articles, some of them authored by this panel, that when it comes to separation of boundaries, this convention didn't give at least any number. ecological question is another lingering problem, at least to be used as a tool of convenience. And President Rouhani left the gathering with his own set of reservations, only to find himself in the hot water back home. So, Bruce, maybe we can start with you. So let's break down some of these issues. My feeling is that the outcome wasn't what you exactly expected, Bruce. What went wrong? And what could solve the sticking points that came on the way of any resolution?
Well, yeah, I mean, when Rouhani started talking about border division and, you know, further talks, and of course, he made some comments about not just the foreign militaries, but when he referred at the end of his speech to foreign military cargo, too. The other presidents in their opening remarks and pretty much in their closing remarks stuck with topics that they wanted to emphasize were important, that were part of the Caspian Agreement that everyone had. Now, it was my expectation anyway that when we came and we watched this, that this was just going to be the last word and we were all going to be good with this and everyone would be satisfied and go ahead with whatever projects they were kind of planning. But Rouhani's comments indicated that there were some issues anyway that Iran was not totally satisfied with, which seems strange because, like I said, it's, you know, 52 meetings of working groups, fifth summit they've had on this, 22 years. Like, how could you show up at this big summit and then try to imply that there might be some wiggle room here and there's need for other things to be discussed? You know, now how to resolve these problems, that's a good question. You know, I do Central Asia obviously all the time. And so, you know, the Turkmen-Iranian relations are not good right now. Turkmenistan could use good relations with Iran for a lot of reasons, if nothing else, for part of transit, part of the, you know, Obor and things like that. So, but we know that there's a problem over this gas issue, which dates back, you know, 10 years of Turkmenistan saying that they want this payment. So it's not so much the Caspian, I think, that's a problem with some of this stuff as outside issues that play a role in the relationship between these countries and why Iran might take a certain position that maybe really has not much as much to do with the Caspian as it does with a bilateral relationship it has with Turkmenistan, say, or something like that. But they're going to have to try to resolve this so that they get themselves on good terms. Now, another big question about this is what exactly do Russia and Iran talk about when they talk about the Caspian Sea? We know that Russian and Iranian relations are on a different level than they were, you know, 5 years ago. They cooperate in Syria. They are both targets of U.S. sanctions at the moment. So they have a lot that brings them together, that keeps them in common. And what kind of deals they agree to in the back rooms without Turkmenistan, Azerbaijan, and Kazakhstan knowing about is another question. What does Russia offer something to Iran to calm them down about the Caspian deal, or do they, you know, behind closed doors support some Iranian positions and say, we won't come out publicly and say anything about this, but we understand your concern and go ahead and press your case and see what happens. So it's still, you know, in my mind, it ended up being a very confusing picture at the end. I couldn't call it the great deal that everyone expected. I'll just leave it there.
Dr. Kutler, I understand your points. Even if the convention resolves every issue legally, politically, it appears that there are things yet to be resolved. So what to do about those issues? Are those points, from your point of view, compromisable? I guess my question is, how far are the parties from any compromise on these issues that Bruce just mentioned?
Well, I think that Mr. Vashakmadze is much closer to that situation, so I would defer to his judgment about it. I might just address the issues that you introduced when you brought us back from the break, very briefly, to clarify for the audience that while it is true that the convention itself did not give a number, as you put it, for the delimitations, the text of the convention, Article 8, refers to the application of, quote, generally recognized principles, unquote, of international law. And I can offer you the insight that under international law, there are three such generally recognized principles, one of which, as you know, the modified median line has been applied by other parties in the Caspian Sea in the past. All three of these methods give almost identical results. People have looked at them on the maps and applied them. The idea that Iran should get 20% of the seabed is not a generally recognized principle. So that's totally out the window. Sometimes you'll hear a figure of 11%. Sometimes you'll hear a figure of 13 to 14%. 13 to 14 is the correct figure there. 11% refers to the Iranian shoreline as a percentage of the perimeter of the Caspian Sea. That's just the first clarification I would offer. The second clarification on your second point is about the ecological issues, which Mr. Whitlin also introduced, and correctly so, mentioning the Tehran Convention signed in 2003, which is about the protection of the marine environment of the Caspian Sea. It's no coincidence, to take up an old phrase, that 3 weeks before the Aktau conference on July 20th, there was signed a protocol to the Tehran Convention, the Moscow Protocol on Environmental Impact Assessment in a transboundary context, which is applicable to all sorts of energy pipelines. Although if you look in the annex to the agreement, to the protocol, there are 24 different kinds of enterprises, wastewater, cement factories, you know, everything that could possibly have a transboundary effect. Now, the relevant point here is that in the Moscow Protocol, it is directly stated that the decision to implement any project will be taken by the party who, under whose jurisdiction the proposed activity is planned to be implemented. So in the past, it's been said that a five-way agreement would be needed, for example, to build the pipeline. The Moscow Protocol, together with the Aktau Convention, make clear that this is not so. And the process by which anything may be delayed is, in the case of the pipeline, I think, not quite as applicable, cannot be so much delayed, because as it says in the protocol, basically one party is going to say, we want to build this. And the other parties are going to say, and the other party is not any other party, but another party that thinks it will be affected, will say, well, what about X? And what about Y? And what about our concerns about beaches and so on and so on? And then they state through diplomatic channels their concerns, and then they receive a reply through diplomatic channels, and then the project can proceed. Mm. It's as simple as that. And in this connection, the last fact I would introduce is that the World Bank and the European Union already 3 years ago produced an environmental impact report for the Trans-Caspian pipeline using international best practices. And I can say only that from my standpoint, not having read that report, it would be difficult for me to suppose that they failed to address any issue that any literal state might introduce later. So I'm happy for the opportunity to introduce the context there, and that's all I have to say.
Yeah, no, these are really valuable, and there was a reference on ecological issues and Zach on your name, so I will get to that, and I will give a microphone to you to respond on that question. But in terms of numbers that you mentioned, Dr. Kuttler, in response to my intro, you know, there are various numbers like the ones that are coming out from Iran, and some say 50%, 20%, 11%, 13%, referring to Iran's ownership, referring to various conventions that they think they signed in the past, even dating back to Soviet Union. And I also understand the references that you give on international conventions and documents that were signed in the past, which you said resolves all the questions. Then why aren't those conventions enough for Iranians, which brings up again those numbers? And also it brings me back to my earlier question that, okay, even if there is no legal issue left to be resolved about the Caspian delimitation or the resources, political issue remains a question. So how to deal with the politics of this? Dr. Kuttler?
Well, yeah. I am not a close observer of Iranian events, but I think that anyone would be able to see that there's a great deal of political ferment inside Iran today, and that the leadership and indeed the political structure of the regime fails to have a consensus amongst the population, which suffers much more so than is explained in the Western press, from economic deprivation, not to mention police repression. And so, of course, there's going to, and even in the Majlis in Iran, there are objections to the policies, in particular the economic policies of the regime in place in Iran. So you mentioned the past treaties. Some places one encounters the opinion that Iran gave away so much because it used to have 50% of the sea. That assertion is based on the fact that the 1935 and 1940 treaties between Iran and the Soviet Union defined the Caspian as a, quote, Soviet and Iranian sea, unquote. But it never delimited any waters. It never mentioned delimitation of waters, and open parenthesis, it certainly didn't talk about exploitation of energy resources. So Iran being one of two parties to that, to those treaties, is the basis on which there's alleged to be or asserted to be a 50-50 split. It's not so. The 20% comes from the long-standing Iranian assertion that the seabed should be shared in a manner that can be translated either as equally or equitably. And as I mentioned before, 100 divided by 5 is 20, so that means to them 20%. But again, that is not, as I believe I said, not generally recognized principle of international law. So it, under the terms of the convention, it holds no water either. So, and I mentioned that where the 11% comes from. So that's what I'll say about number 13 to 14 is... Everyone's agreed on it up until the signature of the convention. I mean, all of the specialists, all of the international lawyers and so on. Now, that's about the number. About the ecological aspect, there is the Moscow Protocol, which I mentioned, to the Tehran Convention that provides for the means by which ecological concerns may be voiced. But it's not something that provides for an eternal delay of things that can be taken up again and again and again, because the party that's implementing can simply say, we've consulted, you had questions, these are the answers to your questions, we are now going to proceed. And that's a reasonable way to do things.
Okay, so let's, Dr. Kutler, let's bring Zach on this. Zach, you heard Dr. Kutler on in terms of ecological questions there. It seems that, you know, legally, again, there shouldn't be an issue on ecological question. But again, we are talking about more than just legal issue. There are political issues, which has its own path. So what do you see the ecological issues is still relevant when it comes to implementations of the articles that were mentioned, discussed, signed in the latest convention?
Yeah, so but essentially the bottom line for me is that politics comes before. And if we are talking about a multinational commercial project in the Caspian Sea, there is no such thing as a legal agreement that would be sufficiently ironclad as to protect any project from further disputes. And I believe that based on the way that the treaty has been set up, even with the rights to beginning and proceeding with those projects secured, and the beginning of a process, let's say, for raising environmental concerns throughout this, there can always be a disagreement or a dispute that's brought up. I think the dispute resolution process that would then be activated is not entirely clear and is necessarily must be viewed as not just a legal issue, but a political one. And therefore, for any project to proceed, it will be absolutely critical to receive the right assurances and guarantees at the diplomatic and political level before going ahead. And that's why I maintain a certain degree of skepticism. And I think that's why there has not been a universal sort of excitement or enthusiasm for a convention that really does represent a historic agreement. It just is also a reminder, I think, as Georgie mentioned before, that many of these issues require further talks on the sides between the parties, whether or not they have agreed or disagreed on those. I think it's important to keep in mind regarding Iran's position in particular. And I do agree that Iran is a very important factor for understanding how this convention came about and some of the issues associated with this. In principle, Iran is still making a concession in the position here. While it is true that in the run-up to this, they'd been leading in this direction, and they saw the writing on the wall, it was never really a tenable position to win, given that 4 out of 5 parties agreed that the Caspian was a sea and not a lake, but they still signed that convention. And when the speed really began picking up, I think, late last year, and we first got signs that this convention might actually happen in 2018 and get scheduled and sign the legal status, Iran was still a party to the JCPOA. It was not until H.R. McMaster left, John Bolton came in, and very quickly soon after, the United States withdrew from the JCPOA sanctions were assured and are now beginning to snap back against Iran. The Iranian economy is under a lot of pressure, and the Iranian President Rouhani is in a lot of hot water, I think, politically from his domestic opponents for signing into an agreement or pushing for an agreement that fell apart here. And so I think we need to view the signals that we're hearing from Iran within that context here, both in terms of they, in principle, made a concession here and should expect to be getting something out of this in return for doing so. And it will be especially important that President Rouhani has something to show for this in, let's say, the coming months or within the next year. Hmm. I think that talks with Russia and Turkmenistan will be absolutely critical within that regard.
Hmm. Wow, this discussion is really fun, but we also need to wrap up the discussion. So, Mr. Oshakmatsa, I promised you to get back to the Turkmen-Azerbaijan, the Trans-Caspian pipeline. If we have a time, we will discuss that. But question that which was raised by other panelists is the political issues, how to deal with that. Even if there is no legal issues, the problems that exist in Caspian Sea and the resource sharing, it appears that there are lots of political issues. Again, the Iranian position kind of explains that. So from your point of view, what are those lingering political issues, and is it compromisable by the countries, and how far those participating nations are from each other to get into a compromise?
Well, that's clear that there are a lot of political issues. The idea of highlighting which particular political issues are applicable to which particular process isn't something rewarding. But because the overwhelming attitude is, of course, this healthy skepticism about all these things, that is triggered by 22 years of the ongoing process, and then people thinking that, okay, now something will actually will put an end to everything, and this is not the case. Now, the good approach would be is to go from issue to issue. Hmm. Yes, there will be a lot of fight ongoing about who will own what from the point of view of exploration production rights. That's not something which we've been expecting this. Some people have been expecting this, but that's an ongoing process. That's very difficult to predict when this will end up. Similarly critical is to distinguish the issue of the pipeline. The pipeline has been outside this issue for long, and parties been trying to keep it separate. Other parties wanted this to be apart, hoping to win that Turkmenistan and Azerbaijan would agree that there will be a need for a consent from all five parties. Apparently, the process has developed in a way that other parties have understood that it's not going to be achieved, and for the sake of the process in the other field, they had to compromise. Or something different happened. Other parties have assumed that it's not really a huge interest for us to prevent these pipelines from happening. So even this approach is difficult, because then you will have arguments for why it is no more a problem for the country, or why it is still, and the balance is huge. This whole agreement is a result of enormous amount of balancing acts.
Hmm. So then,
from the point of view of environment, yeah. And please, just after I just wanted to say, we are extremely happy what we have seen on the paper. And we are very happy that this is very close to what actually is a normal practice. And even outside the Caspian Sea, even in the Black Sea, there are aspects where the pipeline has to consult all five coastal countries. So the huge issue here is that the rules are there. Yeah, anybody can violate. Treaties imply that if circumstances change, treaties may be violated. It's a normal life. Can happen, but why we should think that this will inevitably ruin something? With environmental things, a critical thing, and maybe this is what have been missed by the world community looking to this process, is that there is a very clear activation of the interest about the oil pipeline across the Caspian Sea. For the oil pipeline, it might be really much more difficult in comparison with the gas pipeline to answer to all questions. As Mr. Cutler said, the issue, how it will work, is that there will be concern, and concerns have to be answered in a good faith. Now, we should not forget that there are 5,000 kilometers in pipelines already he owns the seabed of the Caspian Sea. Mm-hmm. And we have not heard any major disasters or minor disasters, except in the north part, where there was a big issue with Kachagan. Otherwise, yes, we have the instruments in practice. The environmental scoping that Mr. Cutler mentioned has been performed by one of the best companies in the world, RSK Radian. They know this. And their conclusions, and I obviously have this report, and this report is a cornerstone of further works for engineering and so on, which is ongoing now. Its conclusions are extremely clear. The summary is on the web. Everybody can see it. It says that there is no environmental concerns that are of the character of unsurmountable or causing a major problem. So this process will be smooth. And if there will be more political, more healthy optimism also, and more questions asked about Trans-Caspian, rather than just this healthy skepticism which we have for 20 years, for many reasons, and overwhelmingly, actually, very little amount of works which would say why Trans-Caspian can happen. 99% of works you can see is usually asks the question, this is why Trans-Caspian cannot happen. And sometimes the arguments are artificially brought and not critically analyzed. Mm-hmm. That's all. So I think that because of this psychological perception that, okay, Russia can always ban it politically, Iran can always ban it politically, it was outside of people's interest. I had an interview yesterday with one of the major consultancy, worldwide consultancy company, who said, we admit that we have not been following Turpin Gas prospects because we thought it's not possible. And now, hopefully, this will be a major result of this. As I said, legally it has not changed anything for Trans-Caspian, but from perceptional point of view it will change a lot, and there will be a much more interest, and there will be a possibility to answer questions and get interests involved. Because in the end of the day, well, we're not talking about pipeline. What we're talking is about Europe's benefit, Europe's consumers' benefit. What we are talking about is that cementing Central Asia closer with the West, which is in everybody's interest who wants kind of good thing about this part of the world. It's about strengthening South Caucasus, where much more political interest will appear if Caspian will become a bigger supplier to Europe than just merely 10 BCM. And what we talk about is the strengthening of the economics of Georgia, which will benefit, and Georgia having a free trade agreement with Europe will be able to develop based on the better priced gas, which Georgia can get in the same kind of deal as with Shahdanis Consortium, where Georgia gets some significant amounts of gas at the cost arrangement, then Georgia can export petrochemical products to Europe. So that's a lot of positive things.
Mm-hmm. I promise, Mohammed, one brief comment on one thing that Mr. Vashakmadze has said, that it's entirely correct that skepticism is normal. Every pipeline that has ever been built has been subject to skepticism before it was built. I remember writing about the BTC, oil export pipeline, before it became a reality. And every single objection that is raised, with the exception of the subsea issue, it's still ecological, every single objection that is being raised against or to be skeptical about the Trans-Caspian pipeline was raised about the Baku Tbilisi-Ceyhan pipeline, which was built. So skepticism is normal. It's par for the course, and it's to be expected. And we shouldn't exaggerate, in my view, the skepticism, because it's to be expected. Thank you. That's all.
Yeah. So we need to really wrap up our discussion here. So, let's do that with Dr. Cutler, with you. So skepticism aside, so what is next? Is this pipeline project, is this happening now? And when it's happening?
Well, not to second guess, but what happening meaning can mean different things to different people.
The pipeline. Will we see this pipeline project realized?
Well, as I understand it, the project promoter company names a date early, just a few years from now. I know that last summer, for the first time, at the level of head of state, Azerbaijan and Turkmenistan together signed a declaration, a protocol to a whole bundle of agreements, declaring for the first time that they will work together to export Turkmen gas to Europe. What's necessary is that the physical work begin. Although I don't have any privileged information about it, I would suppose that if it has not already begun, because the European Commission is co-funding the studies necessary for that work to begin or for the prices to be set, along with the government of Georgia. And when those studies are complete, one may expect contracts to be signed for sale and purchase, and on the basis of by European shippers with Turkmenistan, because Turkmenistan sells gas at its border.
Mm-hmm.
And on the basis of those contracts, one might expect the pipeline to begin construction.
Okay, very promising, but why Turkmenistan is not happy, I don't know. So, Bruce, let's take your point briefly on this. So, what did this convention resolve, and what is the next step you are looking ahead?
Obviously, I'd like to see the EU chime in on this. And, you know, I mean, they've included the Trans-Caspian Pipeline as one of their you know, priority projects for many, many years now. In fact, you know, Shevchovich was saying not so long ago, just a couple of years back, he thought it would be done by 2019. You know, ultimately, these are five countries that consider themselves to be neighbors. The Caspian is one of many issues that tie them together. Some issues they agree on and some they don't. My biggest fear is that something like the Trans-Caspian Pipeline will be held hostage by disagreements that two countries or more have between each other that really have nothing to do with the Trans-Caspian Pipeline at all, but they're looking for concessions in some totally different area of their relationship. So we really got to see how well they're going to get along. You know, I made reference earlier that Iranian-Turkmen ties are not really good, so you can imagine that Iran might not be favorable to some looking at the Trans-Caspian Pipeline without at least pitching that maybe we have environmental concerns and see if they can't slow it up. Not so much to slow up the pipeline as to get Turkmenistan to modify its behavior and some other aspect of the relationship. So I would say if Turkmen-Iranian relations would get better, then I would be much more optimistic about a Trans-Caspian pipeline being laid.
Well, Zach, final point from you.
Sure. And first, thank you very much to the colleagues on this podcast for making really excellent points here. And as a good American, I feel the need to also have a note of optimism, at least a little bit of it. It's quite true that some extraordinarily difficult pipeline concepts have gotten off the ground and succeeded, and some of them have also not been able to work out for the types of reasons that we were discussing before. So I think the point that I would emphasize about where we are right now is we're looking for the deal behind the deal, or rather the deals behind the deal, is the sort of agreements that speak to the broader relationships amongst the parties to ensure that there's a proper level of consensus for the governments and perhaps investors associated with these projects to have confidence that they'll be able to get off the ground and move forward. I'm willing to say that I think the odds of this happening are actually rising. I think that there is positive momentum right now. What I'm not willing to say is that sufficient progress has been made to expect to see the Trans-Caspian Pipeline get started within, say, the next 2 years. And so we'll be watching and updating our views, of course, and let's see what happens.
Mm-hmm. Okay, thank you very much, Zach Whitlin, Eurasia analyst at the Eurasia Group in Washington, D.C. And also thank you very much for your insights, Bruce Panier, editor of Radio Free Europe, Radio Liberty, Central Asia blog, Kishlak Owazi, Georgi Washakmadze, the Georgian Prime Minister's advisor for the East-West Energy Corridor, and Dr. Robert Kuttler, senior research fellow at the Institute for European, Russian, and Eurasian Studies at Carleton University. Thank you very much for your time and thoughts today.
Thank you very much.
This is it from me, Mohammed Tahir, host of the Majlis Ready for Europe, Radio Liberty, Central Asia podcast. Until next week, bye-bye.